The title of the forum is on creative solidarity. And the word solidarity is one that is around a lot. I have just been corrected. The full title is Namibia and South Africa, Creative Solidarity for the Long Haul.
But we can't hear you very well.
You cannot? Okay. The full title is Namibia and South Africa, Creative Solidarity for the Long Haul. And probably the best definition of solidarity that I have come across is really a very simple one, that of walking with people in their struggle. And we could talk about creative solidarity in reference to a number of contexts. We could be looking at Central America, we could be looking at the Dene people of Northern Canada, we could be looking at development education or hunger or any one of a number of different issues. But tonight we will be looking particularly at South Africa and Namibia because we have been during this week talking about those issues here at the village. And the question that we're asking is simply, what do we who struggle to be in solidarity with people in South Africa and Namibia do after we've written the letters? And there is seemingly no significant change. And how is it that we work against that feeling of frustration and impotence that comes when you work and work and work and there are perhaps no identifiable progress that has taken place? In Central America, many people are talking about theology of captivity that accompanies theology of liberation. Theology of liberation was articulated most hemispherically after 1970, and there was great optimism at that time. That was prior to the revolution in Nicaragua. And now, some almost 20 years later, the question is, how do we develop a theology of captivity, a theology that will sustain us during the long haul? And we as North Americans need to ask that question as well, because what we run into, quite simply, is disillusionment and burnout. As we look at South Africa and Namibia, many of you have been in solidarity work around that issue for the long haul. In South Africa, there has been a state of emergency for at least a year, and in Namibia, it has been much longer than that. Nelson Mandela has been in prison for as many years as Holden Village has been in existence. The ANC, African National Congress, has been struggling since 1912. And so we are faced with a situation of having to walk with people who are in struggle and walk with them for the long haul. And we have some panelists this evening who will help us to focus the question of how we do that.
We've selected three people from the Holden community this week to serve as our panelists to give us a perspective on this creative solidarity from both within and without. Marion Loveday is from South Africa, from Cape Town. Many of you have met her already these past couple of weeks. L. David Brown, Bishop of the Iowa District and soon to be Bishop of the Northeast Iowa something, New Church. Thank you. And Charles Lutz, who was with the Church and Society Office of the American Lutheran Church, were among the last two North American church people to be able to enter Namibia. They went last spring on a tour to meet with the church and people of Namibia, a tour that I was hoping to go on in June with a Canadian delegation when we were denied permission to enter South Africa 2 days before we planned to leave. But David and Chuck bring with them a perspective of long-term solidarity in a number of issues, but also with particular reference to Namibia. We've asked each of the three to speak briefly and to kind of kick off our discussion tonight. Decide who would start the. Chuck, would you mind beginning?
Sure.
David, is that all right?
I believe that part of our difficulty as Christians in the United States with any global issue stems from our sense of U.S. power. There's a kind of reverse or flip side to the analysis that says any problem anywhere in the world is probably the fault of the United States. Well, there's a great deal of truth in that. There's a great deal of U.S. power, political, economic, military, all around the world. I think the other side of that is the feeling among some of us who are activists that if we can just get the United States to change its policy or to bring the right kind of pressure on the problem or the government involved, the problem will be solved. I think it's much more complicated than that. It seems to me that there's a kind of faddishness among us who are activists for social causes in the United States. We want to solve a problem quickly, we lose interest quickly, we get tired and weary in well-doing rather soon. I think some of that is now setting in with regard to Southern Africa. There has been a sense among some of the activist community in the U.S., I believe, and certainly in the churches, that if we can just get divestment accomplished, if we can just get economic sanctions voted, even the relatively weak ones that we have now put in place as a U.S. government, that would bring such pressure on the apartheid system in South Africa that it would crumble and Namibia would be free. My own view is that that's faulty reasoning, that all of those things we must continue to do, but we must not assume that if we can just do something here or in the international community, the change will happen in Southern Africa. My view is that we are at best supportive players on the stage, and the primary actors in that drama are within South Africa and Namibia, and we must never forget that. We can, at their behest, be supportive of them, and that's, I think, what solidarity means. But there's a temptation, at least on the part of U.S. people, to think if we get our act together in the U.S. with our power, that will bring about the change. I don't think it will. And so when it doesn't happen, then we get kind of paralyzed and distressed and depressed that we haven't brought about the change. I think it's a reverse, another kind of U.S. imperialism, in a sense, that says if we just do the right things here, the change will happen. So I want to caution us against that. What then do we do? I think the rather obvious things we continue to do and not become weary in doing them. Praying with and for the people in Southern Africa, listening to them, visiting them if we are able, welcoming them to visit us here and inform us about the reality of their struggle, creating opportunities such as the Lutheran colleges in the U.S. have in the last year or so for Namibian students to come here and get a four-year college degree. Supporting all of those efforts, as well as supporting legislative strategies in our Congress and with the White House. But again, I say, I caution myself, not to think that we are the ones who primarily are going to bring about the change. Now, that is not a counsel of quietism or non-involvement. It is simply to say, let's keep it in perspective, do what we must and can do, but not expect that we are the ones through whom the change primarily will occur.
Well, I must say I feel a bit intimidated, surrounded by all these analytical, theological types, but I just...
We need you.
You haven't heard me yet.
But maybe I can convey just a bit about how people actually feel about what people are feeling in South Africa. When people heard, oh, here I was coming to America, the average black person said to me, who doesn't read, maybe got an education up to grade 8, said, why don't these Americans do anything? Thatcher, Botha, and Reagan are murderers. That's a well-known freedom song.
Are murderers.
And I think there's almost a sense of in South Africa at the moment, of the situation is hopeless. We've had a state of emergency for a year. People are exhausted. People have been living in hiding for a year. We've got 25,000 in detention. You can't speak on the telephone. You can't hold a meeting. It's impossible to organize anything. And there's a sense at the moment, and people are saying, does America know about, does America take any notice of this? Why do they carry on supporting this regime? What is the story? Look what they're doing in Iran and Iraq now. We just don't understand. The big worry was that I'd get bombed by a plane that Gaddafi. Because America's fiddling everywhere, supporting the wrong people. Why won't they support us? There's a sense of hopelessness in South Africa. Everybody's exhausted. We live with the police on our doorsteps. We live with them tapping our telephones. We live with them interrupting our meetings. And the international world is just sitting back, waiting. We don't know for what. And then I got here, and in a way, I feel even more hopeless. There in New York, this is supposed to be the financial capital of the world or whatever, there are more beggars in New York than there are in Cape Town. The way I hear people talking about racialism, the racism present, the economic situation, is as depressing here as it is at home. And I suppose what I bring here tonight is from South Africa a sense of hopelessness. We don't feel support. We feel isolated. We feel that Reagan supports the current situation in South Africa. We feel the majority of of Americans support that. We don't hear much about the people who don't support that. But also maybe the last thing I can say is that the Lutheran Church is possibly an exception and is very well known for the work that it has been doing. And the Birchfields are well known in Cape Town. Other Lutheran pastors as well have been banned, detained, kicked out of the country. And I think I feel very positive towards the Namibian Church, especially in the context of Namibia. The fact that it's actually very hard where we are to actually keep South Africa and Namibia on the world's headlines when you can't actually get a publication out. And it's possibly here that the church can play a role, and I think the Lutheran Church has done.
Thank you.
David. It's really fun to take the third spot. You thought through four or five shrouds of ideas that you might have taken and, you know, see them bounce over one after the other. I think I shall not forget soon that when we landed, and I'm not going to just focus a little bit on Namibia because I'm afraid that's where very little focus comes. We do get some news out of South Africa. Of course, we get almost absolutely nothing from Namibia. Where
in the secular press.
Well, in secular press, yeah. But even then, you know, the other is so minimal that it's just, you know, it's kind of childish. And so here we are with half a million Lutherans in Namibia, some of the most joyful, marvelous Christians I have ever met in my life. I have never seen Christianity like that. We were talking a little bit about Dostoevsky today in this room, and we went from Namibia up to Ethiopia where, you know, we experienced the totalitarianism of the right and the left. Same methods, same techniques. I mean, you know, the differences are minimal. The cruelty, intimidation is beyond anything that we can really describe, you know, in polite company. But I'll never forget going into Windhoek in Namibia, the capital, and coming together with the so-called Council of Churches there. The director of the Council of Churches is a person that many of us have known for a long time because he studied here in this country. And we weren't quite prepared for the kind of reception we got, because for 2 hours we got a dressing down from those people, properly so, who said, here are a bunch of 15 other Americans coming here. They want us to teach them some more about Namibia and about solidarity and about a lot of things. And we just are plain tired of doing that, because we know nothing's going to happen. When you go back home, you'll be, you know, you'll tell some stories and that'll be what really is happening. we got up to northern Namibia shortly thereafter, and we're not, I don't think I was even begin to be prepared for the kind of military establishment. They say it's probably the most strongest military establishment in the world in any in that northern Namibia area.
10 to 1 soldiers to civilians.
I mean, and it's worse than on some people's books, because, you know, and the intimidation that goes on night after night after night. I mean, it just, you just, you don't believe that those people can take that kind of stuff much longer. I mean, there's got to be a breaking point. And yet, of course, what you really finally understand very quickly is that somehow God has done something with those people that he hasn't done in many places around the world, and certainly not here in this country. So that maybe I think the thing that we really need to begin to do is to listen to those very pointed and strong voices out of places like Namibia and South Africa, who have somehow, in the distillation of a crucible, have been able to say some things that are very simple and yet very direct and very profound. And I think that's one of the things that we need to school ourselves in. We need to get to reading some of the Christians in those parts of the world and hear what they have to say, because they are saying much more, I think much more, than theologians in North America and the West generally. Certainly they're saying more things that are more important to be heard. What are we going to do? And I think that's a focus for tonight, and I think we need to have that focus. As has already been said, you sometimes get very tired of trying to do some things, and then we work in fads and we get over that and then we go something else. Or you have to deal with the kind of hopelessness which you know in Cape Town, you know, which is just so oppressive, because nobody knows what's going to happen. And we sit here and really wring our hands and don't know what to do either. We've started a little something which is called a Free Namibia Emphasis, which it really is built on the principle, I think, of the right kind of communication for our kind of a day, and that is to set up networks of people all over this country and to expand those networks. And we do have abilities now to get within one day of London to hear what's going on day by day. Just before we left, one of the great pillars of the Christian world, one of the greatest leaders we have in the Christian world, Bishop Cleophas Dumeny's son, was killed just before we came here now. And we would not have heard that except for this kind of networking that has gone on thus far. And I don't know quite how you plug into all that networking, but I know you can do that through your own district and synod outfits. And we just plain got to know more about what's happening over there. We got to keep up some kind of a knowledge of the terrible and terrifying things that are happening. But also, with what Chuck mentioned about these Namibian students that are coming over here, they have no really college of higher learning there that they can go to that's satisfying to them. So they're coming over here, they're extremely bright people, and they're very articulate about the faith. And if you ever have a chance to get a Namibian student in your congregation, you will not forget that experience. I don't care who it is. I mean, I've just seen too many of them that are just, you know, so, they've been in that crucible, and they know what it is to live with joy in the midst of terrible oppression, and they know how to make that witness very strong and powerful. So I think we have a few clues. We've got to know more. We've got to learn more from them. Surely the North American church is a lukewarm church. We're ready to lose our soul. We've got to have some kind of a listening tune into some of those parts of the world where God is doing, literally, the gospel is exploding, maybe like it never has since our Lord ascended to heaven. So, you know, we've got to begin to listen to those people, set up our networks, and get more people involved, and let our commitment ring true. I think so many people get tired of social activism because there's not much spiritual depth to it. And you don't talk to a South African Christian or Namibian Christian and recognize it and don't see that the fact that yes, we don't have much depth in this country. Our Christianity is very much a veneer next to the kind of powerful witness which so many of them make. We've got to hear that witness, and we've got to try to act upon it as best we are, as our knowledge can see it here.
Thank you, all three of you. Thanks very much. Reactions and comments from others now. How for you has there been a link of solidarity with Southern Africans, Namibians and South Africans? Or what has sustained you over the long haul? I can give a couple of suggestions. Oh, yes, sure.
This afternoon, for the very first time, I had read the Harar Declaration and the Lutheran Church in America's response to that. And in that, and I have it with me, they listed like 10 items of action that they planned on doing about a year ago. And I, having read through those, I know that our church has taken part in some of them, like the World Day of Prayer and the dissemination of certain information. But how do you feel the Lutheran Church has followed through on all the other things that they said they were going to do?
Could I just give a bit of context on that? We've got copies of it here we can send around. I think if every other person takes one, they'll probably reach all the way. The Harare Declaration came out of a meeting organized by the World Council of Churches in Harare, Zimbabwe in December of 85, to which were invited church leaders from Europe, North America, and Southern Africa. It was really requested by the Southern Africa churches. And the declaration is very brief. It's on one side of this sheet. And it states certain things that that group came to a consensus about. The response of the U.S. church leaders to it is a U.S. church leader's statement that followed, I think, in January, the following month, saying, these are the things we will do, and that's what you're alluding to.
Right.
And your question is, what is happening with regard to those
right.
those
everybody's
pledges?
Everybody's saying, what can we do?
Yeah.
It seems like those are some things they decided they should do. Have they followed through?
Well, let's just go down the list very quickly. Organized lobbying effort with Congress in cooperation with the Washington Office on Africa and the Washington offices of our churches. That has been done and is and continues to be done. It's very frustrating because it's hard to see any movement in either the Congress or the administration. But the effort goes on. It's rather, I think, quiet and behind the scenes, but the attempt is a continuing one. Request a meeting with the administration. That request was made. It has not happened. President Reagan has generally refused to meet with any of the mainline, the so-called mainline denominational leaders, on any issue. He just doesn't seem to want to talk to them. Although there has been a meeting with Secretary meetings with Secretary Crocker, the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Several of those have happened. Plan for a day of prayer and fasting. That happened, David, I think in June of 86, wasn't it? And were you there?
I was
in Washington? There were several of our bishops who were there and other leaders from grassroots people from across the church, across the U.S. in Lutheran churches, and it was an ecumenical affair. It was people from other denominations as well. Disseminate information on South Africa among our congregations and local and regional ecumenical bodies. That effort continues to go on. Support the NCC, National Council of Churches, effort to raise funds for South Africa. I'm not aware of what's happening with regard to that. Develop a plan to our government to institute comprehensive sanctions against the present South African government. Well, you perhaps know that the churches in this country generally have supported strong sanctions, stronger sanctions than have been voted thus far. The next deadline or date to watch for, I think, is September of 87, when the first year of the present sanctions bill or act will have expired. And then the Congress is to take a new look at it. And promise was a year ago that if nothing significant had happened in the dismantling of apartheid during this year, Congress would take sterner measures, like, you know, a complete ban on all trade or something of that sort. But that debate will be reopened this fall. Continue and expand our church's present efforts in areas of divestment. You may want to talk about that a little bit. What have the churches done there? Some of the churches have moved farther than others on that, selling their own stocks, that is, in companies that do business in South Africa. Work with local and regional councils of churches to urge state governments to divest state funds. Some of that is going on. Work with business leaders in our churches to interpret the South Africa situation. All rather general points. I would say that in general, there is something being done in each of those areas. How effective it is, I think we won't know for some time, and more always could be done.
I think the frustrating thing about that is you know, what, how does that really tie in to some local congregations and grassroots, you know, input? And if, you know, we're just talking through our hat with a lot of this stuff, because if we don't start generating some really committed people in local areas, and I'm not talking about great masses of people with huge delegations, but, you know, a few people who can be committed enough to keep the letters going and to keep the pressure up and that kind of thing, you know, we're not going to get very far. And I think that's what we need to look at more directly. It's
really hard if you look at the pastor, though, doesn't pass on any information at all, and, like, you know, doesn't support outwardly. I mean, he may say, of course, all that, but, I mean, doesn't do anything within the congregation to get that information out. It's hard for the average person to know what to do, like to plug in.
Does your congregation have a library?
Yes, sort of.
Of sorts?
Nobody takes care of it.
If the congregation could subscribe to such things as Lutheran World Information or the Namibian Communication Center newsletters, that would be one way of getting around the pastor's wastebasket. Steve, and then a couple comments over here. Marilyn?
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on a number of the points that were raised. And it's something that I've been working with a few congregations while I've been here, and that's the project of twinning congregations in South Africa and Namibia with congregations here in North America as a creative response of solidarity. Because from, I think, what people have heard and perhaps through the sessions, one of the things that's really needed is this long haul idea. Desmond Tutu said after the most recent elections in May that we've entered a new dark ages. The word struck me because it was the church that actually kept society going during the dark ages. And I wondered whether the church was going to have to play some kind of monastic experience now. This theology of captivity, this idea of keeping things going in the long haul. And also those kinds of 10 ideas, isn't it the case that it's the church leaders who have to do that? And the Committee on Solidarity in El Salvador also wants their 10 points done by the church leaders, and the Committee on Solidarity in the Middle East wants their church leaders to do 10 points. And the church leaders get tired and bored, I mean, or just up in arms. And I wonder if the idea of taking through the World Lutheran Federation, your church to twin with the church in Namibia or South Africa, with the Lutheran church, wouldn't be a creative idea, so that the regular parishioners can write letters to the regular parishioners, that you can have a joint Eucharist on one Sunday every year, that you can share your prayers of intercession. Not only so that Americans can support and meet that need that Marion was talking about, that sense of we're out here all alone, and nobody loves us anymore. But also because I think the church in America can learn a tremendous amount from the church in Southern Africa, and that the twinning is a two-way concept. And I wonder if that wouldn't work with some congregations. Other congregations might not work. But I think that might... It's more organic, because the life of the church is an organ rather than just a committee of people.
How could we do that? If we're interested in bringing that to our church, how can that be done? What specific thing do we do?
Can I respond to that? Because I know it feels hard. Like, how are we going to get into that? But actually it isn't. And it isn't something that you have to have really knowledgeable and sophisticated participants to get at. All you need is two or three people within your congregation who are willing to covenant together to begin learning something about South Africa. And then what you do is you start by identifying people in your local area, and they're there, and there are people who can help put you in touch with them. If your pastor can't, just be like the persistent widow. Keep asking until you find the people who know how you can get started. And what you do is you think in three areas. Think study, service, and action. And study means simply learning everything that you can about South Africa, and twinning can be a really good way of doing that. In our congregation, for example, our Sunday school has gotten involved and gotten twinned with a school in Zimbabwe. And letters have been going back and forth, and they've been learning songs and different words in Shona and all kinds of things. Then service becomes just the sheer need of keeping funds going into, in the States it would probably be, well, I don't want to say, but anyway, funds going into whatever ways you have in the States to get them into Lutheran World Federation so that there's some money to work with there, but then also action. And as you learn more and get in touch with the people who are working on it in your area, it will become clear to you. So find two other people who will work with you and covenant together to start on it, and it will come.
Part of my question was answered here. I'm going to ask it anyway, because most of the response I've heard has been stated in the negative. I am against whatever it is, and in this case, apartheid. I have really not heard, other than now, a positive response to that as, you know, part of a road to a solution, where you are dealing with a government that has a vested interest in the status quo. And I'm wondering if any of you can, anyone in the room, can share what might be an advocacy position that would actually result in change.
You're talking about South Africa.
South Africa, particularly.
Do you want to respond to that?
I guess I can respond, not in the American context, but from a Canadian situation. I belong to ACTR, which is the official Writers and Actors Guild in Canada. And some of the writers, we have a signed contract, a certain percentage from our employer and from our own contract money goes into a pension plan. And some of the writers decided to investigate where the money from that pension plan was going, and found out that there was some of it being invested in South Africa. So basically, those writers took it upon themselves to poll the rest, the whole union, to find out if there were enough people interested in forming a separate, what I guess you would call, investing in a plan that would not be involved in South Africa, or would not be involved in nuclear things, but basically an idea. And there was a great deal of controversy about it, because people were very uneasy because they were getting a good percentage coming back on the pension plan. I mean, what would happen if we changed? I mean, would we drop and lose everything? And we didn't. And basically, it was people taking a chance, and it wasn't through the government, it wasn't through anything. It was a few concerned people that decided to take it upon themselves to find this out and check with others. And I think that is also a way of doing it, checking where your pension plans are being invested in, what might be a possibility of going into. There's a number of plans, investment organizations that are ethical investment corporations that are springing up. I know there are a number in the States, and there are also a number in Canada that allow for that. And that's one possibility.
Same questions being asked by the National Church, the Lutheran Church in Canada, next week at their national convention in Ottawa.
ALC, the good government.
So just to mention, though, I don't think we ought to be talking only Lutheran here, because, you know, sure, it's the administration's vested interest almost to keep things status quo. They supported this fool Savimba, you know, and that's what did Namibia in. Because here's an old Marxist that's fighting for any side they can get some money from.
Excuse me, David, I'm not speaking of, I'm speaking of the administration in
Oh, South in Africa. South Africa, okay.
Yeah, not, not.
But I do have to say that I think Congress has had about much, as much as it's going to have from our administration, and I think there's some vulnerability there that I think is being worked on that I think needs to be looked at.
I guess my point is, what difference does it make what Congress does South Africa? In South Africa.
I think I feel quite strongly about this, that if America would keep out of South Africa, we could actually solve our own problems. US and US money is actually going to be the end of us in the end. Because look at America in terms of world policy. America supports every right-wing dictatorship. What are they doing in South Africa at the moment? Actually supporting the apartheid system. We can actually take on the South African government, but we are not strong enough. We have not the arms. We have not the technology to take on America.
I just want to respond to the comment by pointing to what I see as a real difference between South Africa and Namibia. They're intertwined. The basic problem in Namibia, of course, is occupation illegally by the South African apartheid regime. But they're also very different in that the Namibian issue is truly an international issue. It is on the international agenda. It is the problem of the international community. And the question then is how to bring the right kind of pressure on South Africa to get out and obey international law. Because international law, clearly, from the United Nations through the World Court, has declared that the continued presence of South Africa in Namibia is illegal. Even South Africa has agreed, the government of South Africa has agreed in principle to abide by the implementation of UN Resolution 435. It's very clear, in some ways very simple, what the world community has said about Namibia. There should be free elections under UN supervision. That's UN 435. The United States government agreed to that, helped to draft it, and get it through the UN, in fact. And to the end of the Carter administration was pressing the South African government to implement it. Just as the end of the Carter administration happened, there was a meeting in Geneva where a couple days before the inauguration of Ronald Reagan, South Africa walked out, left the talks. Since then, for 7 years now, there's been no progress on that. There are some now who believe that Namibia's freedom won't happen until South Africa is free. I don't know how others feel about that, but for a long time the world community felt that we were right on the edge of solving the Namibia problem, getting independence for Namibia and free elections. That is now postponed. Will that change when the Reagan administration is replaced? I don't know. But we met many in Namibia, David, who believed that the primary block to their independence now is not Pretoria, but Washington. That Washington had given the South Africans 8 years of shelter, of safety, from implementing UN 435. So at least with regard to Namibia, I think it's very clear what the world community is for, with a great deal of unanimity. It's for the implementation of that UN resolution that calls for free elections in Namibia at the earliest possible moment. South Africa, I think, is much more complex.
I was just going to comment, and maybe Steve and Marion could help me, but during the Carter administration, when Jimmy Carter was doing his thing on human rights, the statistics on detentions in South Africa were way, way down. South Africa was very aware of the U.S. Pressure on that particular issue. As soon as Reagan was elected, the detentions went right back up, significantly went up. Paul?
Just reflecting on sort of the other side of the fence, not that I'm on the other side of the fence in this question, but we have friends who visited South Africa and Swaziland recently who came back and said that the impact of what the Canadian government has said and done about South Africa and Namibia has been rather marked. In other words, the Canadians are disliked by the right-wing people in South Africa at this point because of what the Canadian government has said. in Canada, we know very well we're not a superpower. We haven't got the kind of influence that you have in the U.S. We know very well, too, that if the U.S. were to take that step, is it Marion was saying earlier, it would make a great deal more difference. But even a smallish country like Canada, because of the pressure that has been put on the South African government through the world community, world attention has been drawn to it, has been rather significant. So what we say to our governments in America makes a great deal of difference.
Yep, I think so. Just on that Canadian point, those of you who live in the Pacific Northwest part of this country, in the fall there's going to be the next Commonwealth Conference, and it's going to be held in Vancouver. And there are already plans by Canadian and other anti-apartheid groups to have a counter-conference in Vancouver to try to press for increased action from the Commonwealth nations for action on South Africa. Did you have another comment?
Yeah, I was just going to add something that Chuck had said. I think the world community has this resolution 435, which enables the Namibia issue to have a focus. I think South Africa's lacked that for a while, and the question, I can't see who it is underneath me here, was asking about everything's against, what are we for in South Africa? And I was going to speak a little bit to that, because I think, as I understand it now, one of the difficulties with South Africa is that the African National Congress is banned and in exile, and it doesn't feel that it can make a blueprint for South Africa, because the decision has to be made by the South Africans themselves. So what it's always called for is a national convention at which the present government, if it's a legitimate elected group, will be there, and all legitimate groups will be there. And I wonder if that's not something that needs to be pushed to the agenda now, and as I understand it, the Washington Office on Africa is wanting to do this now, is to have the African National Congress accepted as a legitimate, the party to which the present government must talk. I think if that could be established, that would create a climate where this present government couldn't get away with creating puppets that it would talk to and tell the world it's talking to blacks. And I think that means countering the kind of rubbish that comes in some American newspapers. I've just read an article that somebody who was here last week mailed to me on return home in Washington State, where the journalist or the columnist was equating the African National Congress with the Contras and saying, how come some Congress people are against the Contras but for the African National Congress? And absolutely no analysis as to what the difference between them is. So I would ask that perhaps that the advocacy position is the ANC must be represented at a national convention with the present government, and that would be a good advocacy position to push. And it's a possible way of going, I think.
There is some legislation coming up in Congress, and it's... Actually, I think it's fair to say, isn't it, Chuck, that it's coming step by step. I mean, there's some very mild kinds of things, but so few people in the Congress know Namibia, for instance, or anything about it, that it almost needs that kind of piecemeal action, which I think would eventually call for some kind of a support of that African National Congress by a lot of legislators.
Other comments? Reactions. Let me emphasize. Oh, excuse me. Go ahead.
I guess I feel that the first thing we ought to do is try to change the policy of our government. I'm not really concerned about the strategy vis-a-vis South African problem situation. We have a great problem in our own country that we don't even have to know anything about South Africa. All we have to know, and we do know, that our government is wrong in most of its activities around the world. If we can clean up a few of those, I think it would give more hope to South Africa, Central America, a 100 other places. And they would be much better able to solve their own problems. I'm not saying how we're going to do that, but as Bishop Tutu said, in the Quad Cities in Illinois recently, Iowa. He said he had given up on President Reagan. He would talk to the people, and he'd also given up on Western European leaders. I think it's time we consider that perhaps Tutu is right. We too have to give up on some of these established leaders and policies and go out and publicly create a policy that is more nearly right. I guess that's what I wanted to say.
Is an election coming?
Yes.
Election won't get it.
Well, but it can, but it can be raised as an issue in ridings and constituencies throughout the country with candidates for Congress. I think
one of the states in the U.S. where the focus comes earliest is Iowa. And I've hoped, and I know Dave Brown has hoped, that Namibia and South Africa would be raised all across that state next February, is it? In the caucuses, in the little gatherings that occur on a certain day or evening in February of 1988. And a lot of Lutheran church people and other church people go to those things and could raise those issues. Frankly, Southern Africa, Central America, any other part of the world is not the primary issue for most American electors when they go to the polls to elect a government. It's economics, it's home community economics or national economics, I'm afraid, that determines how we vote. Somebody's got to raise those other issues of foreign policy and show why they're important and make the connections. That's very hard to do, but I think in a state like Iowa in February of 88, the effort can be made to do it.
It can be said that many people say that we have probably political activity in Iowa right now than almost anywhere in the United States. The commitment to that is very strong. There's an enormous amount of energy being expended right now in that kind of thing. And you know, the caucuses amount to 15 to 25 people around the state. They are bound to listen to some three or four voices that are very strong about some of these things. And that happened in the last caucus to a great degree. The platform was influenced because of some work that was done. I think we need to work through some kind of process.
Marion. Marion wanted to make a point. Can we just?
Yes, I just wanted to link in with what you said about, and also Chuck, what you said about what here Americans, what can you actually do about the situation in South Africa and Namibia? And I think it's quite a frightening thing for me to have realized, having been here for 5 weeks, that actually apartheid, which has arisen out of racism and attitudes like that, exploitation, is actually very much present here. And those are attitudes that can be worked on here in North America. And maybe this is the wrong people to say that to, so maybe I should not say it, but I'll say it anyway.
That,
here in America, I see racism. It hasn't got a label, it hasn't got apartheid stuck on it. And so people pretend it isn't here, but it actually is very much here. And that's actually what you can do in solidarity with what's going on in South Africa and in Namibia, because it's that issue which has led to the situation that we now have to cope with. And that's, in a way, that attitude is that discrimination against minority groups, that is the most solidarity you can actually show with us.
Yes.
I just wanted to make a statement that since the Lutheran leaders have determined through this document that it is very important that we attack apartheid, and they have worked with the government leaders and feel that they haven't gotten very far on several of the issues, perhaps it's time now to turn back to the people and disseminate the information to the people at the grassroots congregational levels, and let them go with that, and get them the information, activate them somewhat, and get them to participate, see that it's not wrong to participate in things like the elections.
Mm-hmm. Well, we pick up on what Marion said.
you know, racism is a profoundly spiritual problem, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't go away with certain nice, neat legislative formulas. I mean, that's only as we work at that where we are, and it is a severe problem that I think we have to admit to somewhere along the line and begin to work at.
Yes, thank you, Steve.
I just have a comment. I think that we as church members oftentimes kind of wait for our pastors to spoon feed us on a lot of these issues, and the pastors don't take a lot of action or lead us by the nose. We just sort of just don't do anything, and I think it's something that every person has to take as being their own personal challenge, and they can't wait for their pastor to sort this out among all the many other things that he has to deal with, to wait to deal with.
Those of you who live in the Twin Cities area have a number of resources that you can, as congregational members, can bring into your congregations at your
right,
own...
Lutheran Standard addresses a lot.
Pardon me?
I said the church paper, the Lutheran Standard addresses a lot of those resources.
I was thinking of a couple of Namibian students that I know of in the Twin Cities. There's a fellow that we brought up to Edmonton, Gabriel Wahengo, who's studying at the University of Minnesota, who's a survivor of the Kasinga massacre. And when he spoke in Edmonton to an assembly of the student body at the University of Alberta, as a peer speaking to peers of the same age, those Alberta students were mesmerized by what was going on and changed. There's a pastor as well, Shekutamba Nambala at the seminary, who's similar to fine speaker.
Just follow that up with a kind of generic comment about the presence of Namibians and South Africans in many of our communities. One word of caution, those who are students are primarily here to be students. They aren't here primarily to go around talking to church groups or other groups, and they can't certainly do it full time. But many of them are willing. Some, for political reasons, are not so willing to speak publicly, but most of them are, within reason, to be available for that. And I would go looking for them to U.S. Lutheran colleges, to seminaries, Lutheran and otherwise, in all of the... North American scene. Are there any Namibian students at seminaries in Canada? There must be.
Not at the seminaries.
Not presently.
There are going to be 12 college students at Camrose Lutheran College this fall.
And then the state universities and provincial universities also have students from South Africa and Namibia, some of whom are prepared to go out and interpret with church and other groups what the realities are.
So there's a question back here.
Yeah, our church is one in Southwest Washington that is will sponsor this fall an Indian student at PLU.
Good.
It's been indicated that very possibly that student might spend some time with us, whether it's a day or two. I think it's going to be a very helpful thing in our Vancouver area to raise this whole problem. And I'm wondering how many students are sponsored this coming fall in church colleges around the country.
My understanding is that last fall there were, I think, 16 who came and started as first-year students. This fall there are another 20, and the goal eventually in the U.S. plan is to have 100 students, one in each of 4 years at 25 campuses, roughly 100 in all, and then to keep that going. So there will always be about 100 students here. Very often we're told they are available over holidays. When the rest of the students go home, they have no place to go. They can't go home to Namibia. So they're often available over holidays to go into congregational settings, like over Thanksgiving, Christmas, and perhaps over summer holidays as well.
And if our churches gave the money across the country, are there 100 students who could come like this fall? Is it a matter of money, you know? We have a few congregations in Southwest Washington who are sponsoring the student. What if we had, would students be available if the money were available?
I don't know. All I know about the plan is that it was designed to have the colleges provide tuition and other money provide international transportation and the money the students need to live while they're here.
And I think in the Northwest, you've been especially, or PLU has been especially effective in raising money for that effort. I heard once it was over 200,000 had been raised. And apparently your congregation is part of that program.
I think it's also safe to say that the screening process is not easy. I mean, they have to do this carefully. And I think the chances also are that if you ask a movement student, you're going to get one who's very articulate, also very pious and devout.
I just wanted to just change the subject a little bit. Speak to the long haul part of the title, and essentially, in some ways, responding to your first question, which nobody said anything. And I hope I can say this without sounding like I'm too romanticizing it, but somehow for me, there's a long way to go with this for me, but I think I'm just starting to have a glimpse of what can be sustaining. I mean, David and a couple other people have mentioned sort of the listening to the other people who are the ones that are in the struggle because they have to be, because they're the oppressed. And I think when we really allow ourselves to be open to that, to have an experience of going to those places or listening to those people here or listening to other people who have had those experiences, that something really happens in that contact, in that dialogue, in that experience that is absolutely unexplainable and is unlike anything that you really experience at other places and other times. And somehow or another through that, I think one becomes almost compelled to enter the struggle. And I don't mean compelled in the sense of some sort of legalistic obligation. There's something out of your very being that becomes something that you almost want to do. It's no longer, again, something that you should do. It's something that you have to do. And having to do it and should do it are two different things. And I think that it's in that then that for me you really start discovering what Christ means when he says, "I have come that you may live and that you may live abundantly." And it's a very different way of it talking about abundance than perhaps we want to. But somehow or other it's a matter of being involved in a struggle, taking the vision absolutely seriously, not saying, "Well, as long as I just keep struggling, it's okay. I don't have to be concerned about the goal," but somehow or another in that paradox of both having to work towards the goal of change and at the same time knowing that it's the struggle itself that sustains you. It is not the actual goal always. It's the struggle, that it's in that response to a call, that sort of being compelled to enter into that, that we are made whole. And that for me is really what we're talking about in many ways when we talk about salvation. That it's that sense of salvation and wholeness that is sustaining because it is found in the struggle. It is not found simply in some kind of baptism which we then put all our rewards, our hope in some rewards afterwards.
As Heschel says, the main sin is self-deceit. So the salvatory act has to have something to do with truth and honesty. And that's what we can't get around in North America. And we are hung up on dichotomizing those things that we no longer can afford to do.
I'm going to change the subject back again. I'm just wondering if Holden can't provide a place for Namibian students, maybe a week or something like that. If there are Namibian students in the area, to be sponsored to come here and spend a week enriching the life of Holden. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to say at the end of having said that, and I think, and I can't speak for Marion, yes, she can speak for herself, but for myself, I have appreciated Holden, and I think that the genuine concern reflected here and reflected in the leadership of the American churches
which I've had some chance of getting to know in New York City, has been tremendous, and I do want to put on record that there is a lot of gratitude and a lot of awareness of that those who join with us and walk with us in solidarity, to use Becky's term, really, we hold their hand and they hold ours, and it's a warm, cuddly feeling.
Mm-hmm. We need to close, I think, quickly, but I wanted to plug...
Yeah, a word about some materials?
Yes. I wanted to plug this challenge to the church, commonly or popularly known as the Kairos document. It's a statement by South African church leaders, which, if you use as an individual or in a study group in your congregation, cannot help but put you in touch with that church and their struggle. And at the same time, you'll find a kind of clarification of our own role as the church in North America. There's some of those issues, additions, have a study guide by David Masonbrink, who I think is still working in New York for somebody.
All of this edition has his study guide. And I think he's at Trinity Episcopal Church now with their program.
But he's also available, David Masonbrink is also available down the hall in the Holden Tate Resource Library. Whether you listen to them here while you're here or take some with you, he is a profoundly insightful and eloquent spokesperson for what's going on in South Africa and Namibia.
Steve is going to do a session tomorrow, Steve and Marion, on the Kairos document. What time?
10:45.
If you think you might want to go to that or have plans to go to it, take one of these with you tonight. There are about 25 of them here, and they won't reach to all, but if you have particular interest in that session, take one of those along and maybe you can glance at it before the session or bring it to the session. Secondly, national church statements, those of us who've worked with them have discovered, don't always have a lot of effect anywhere. But for what it's worth, this is the collection of American Lutheran Church statements anti-apartheid over the last decade or so. It gives you some sense of what one denomination has outlined as strategies for combating apartheid. And so you're welcome if you want it to one of those. And
so
it's
25%
royalty. Oh yes, that's
true. Yeah, I too. Yep. There's a comment up here.
Just one link back to immediate Holden programming that as we get into these weeks that are dealing with the rainbow on the mountaintop, it seems to me the linkage between the domestic racial situations in Southern Africa needs to be thought about in lots of different ways. One of the ways, just to mention, it seems to me that although the mainline churches have been pretty good on this issue, it's clear that the leadership in the United States on this particular set of foreign policy issues is black community leadership. Whether you're talking about the American Committee on Africa, whether you're talking about the Congressional Black Caucus, it is the black community in America which has defined this in the ethical and moral framework which has brought it to the attention of the churches. One of the ways that racism works in the United States in our own apartheid separateness is that few of us have experience working in, with, under, for black leadership. These issues, one other way to look at these issues as Americans, is as a way and a set of opportunities to work with black leadership, which is a way then of addressing both our domestic and foreign policy dilemmas in one breath.
Let me just add that two of the black leaders that will be here were in Harare.
Will Hertzfeld.
Will Hertzfeld,
Pete Pirro.
Yeah.
Yeah, just one last item, and it's a really important aspect of what we've been talking about that we haven't dealt with tonight, and I won't deal with it, but I'd like to mention it because I think it needs to be said, and that is the whole area of alternate information. Steve referred to this article in the paper that compared the ANC to the Contras and said there was no analysis. If we rely on our public secular media for the information that we get out of the world, particularly in the United States, we are not going to be in touch with what is really happening. And for all of the terrible things we say about transnational corporations, we need to realize that the church is a transnational, maybe, community, and that we do operate outside of and above national boundaries, and we do have a global community. And the church press and the church information network is a very precious and I think critically important thing that is available to us in our political world today.